I'm Ken MacLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind. The Nuts and Bolts of Buddhism. Pragmatic Perspectives.
Okay. Any other comments? So, I mean, this is when you really bring attention to livelihood, that you get into all kinds of what I think are delightfully nitty-gritty issues. You know, everything from flattering people so that they'll give you business and doing those things, which, you know, easily slides into manipulation and so forth, to the very basis of the economy and economic and social policy in countries, to how do we live our core values. I mean, it's tremendously rich. And bringing attention to these different facets of life, particularly the facets that we can actually exert some influence over, is vitally important if we're going to realize our intention in Buddhism, which is, as I said a few moments ago, to experience our lives without struggling with what we experience. Well, that's my translation of end suffering. Okay. Anne, please.
Well, I was a businesswoman for 20 years, and now I'm also a grower of pistachio trees. I have 5,000 pistachio trees. And what I've found in terms of morality is that I had to keep asking questions, because ignorance is the thing that keeps you most in the dark about possibility. And after I asked many questions over and over again, being a businesswoman, I had to do things that were less ideal than what I wanted to do in order to be competitive. And in doing farming, I had to look into organic possibility, and it's not possible for me to do organic farming. No one is doing it in that industry.
But right.
Ideally, I would not like to use chemicals.
Right.
So I can be at peace because I haven't been ignorant in my investigation.
Yeah. So you've looked at the situation and you've figured out what is possible, what is viable, and what isn't possible, and what isn't viable.
Right.
Yeah. You know, a friend of mine pointed out an interesting relationship between idealism and pragmatism. One ordinarily thinks of these very different. But a real idealist is very pragmatic because he or she wants to get something done.
Right.
And a person who is very pragmatic, if you look closely at them, is probably pragmatic because they have very strong ideals.
This question was submitted by Thomas from Ohio. What is your position regarding vegetarianism and using products made from animals?
My own position is that I'm not vegetarian, and I wear leather shoes. But I don't think my position is what's important here. Morality in Buddhism, most people or many teachers prefer to regard it as descriptive rather than prescriptive. By that, I mean that what we read as moral behavior is a description of a way a person who is awake and present in their life comports themselves. And there is some benefit, very definitely, from cultivating those kinds of behaviors in oneself. And the main benefit is that by doing so, we create the conditions for our practice to deepen. The way that I like to approach this is very simple. Imagine a situation in which you know what the right thing to do is. And it's going to cost you something. Maybe it's going to cost you some money. Maybe it's going to cost you some time. Maybe it'll cost you a friend, or maybe it'll cost you your job. But you know what the right thing to do is, and you do it. How long do you think about it afterwards? Most people say, I don't. And then I ask them, what if you don't do the right thing? Then how long do you think about it afterwards? And most people say, well, then it weighs on my mind. And this is really the basis of Buddhist morality in the beginning stages of practice. By acting in a moral way, we create the conditions for mind and heart to be quiet and at peace. Now, some people simply can't absorb enough protein from vegetarian sources, and they need to eat animal protein. They aren't moral or less moral because of that. So I think each person has to find what is appropriate for them. And it's not really a case of there being a position or a right or wrong thing to do.
This is from Ryan in Baltimore. I have a 10-year traditional practice, including a few years as a monastic, and have found that it doesn't consistently work for me. On the other hand, I have found that your pragmatic approach speaks to me. I'm trying to understand the difference between the two approaches.
To say that there's a difference between the two approaches arouses curiosity for me. Because the approach that I take very much comes out of my own training. I have found that a lot of people, and myself included, found it difficult to understand how to practice from the traditional formulations. And sometimes through trial and error, sometimes through exchanging experience and discussing things, sometimes by hearing something expressed in a different way. Those of us who were basically in the first generation of Western students have come to appreciate the traditional methods of practice and found different ways of expressing them in English. So I think this may be what you're talking about. I'm not sure because we're not able to speak directly. But let me give you a couple of examples, because I think translation problems can be very significant here. We have the expression, all phenomena are empty. That's one way of saying it, but it's a problem in English, because phenomena refer to the objective pole of experience, when what is being said in Tibetan and in the Sanskrit is all experience is empty, or all experience has no ground. So it's not just about what's out there, it's also about everything that's in here. Now, if you sit with the idea that your thoughts and emotions, etc., are empty, well, they just pop up, and they distract and they disturb, and you end up in this fight with them. But if you shift that slightly, and this is what I think is actually being said in the Tibetan Sanskrit, is the experiences are empty. That is, that they're open. That is, they arise vividly, but there is ultimately nothing to them. Then you move completely out of that sense of opposition and confusion, and it opens the possibility of resting completely in the experience without trying to change or modify it in any way, just being as awake and aware as one possibly can in the experience of it itself. And I think that's what you may be referring to when you ascribe a difference to what you've observed in traditional formulations and what you seem to find resonates in the way that I express things and wake up to your life. I would suggest that it may be that the language makes things more transparent. It doesn't refer to an actual difference in the traditions themselves.
This question is from Phil in Fort Worth, Texas. It seems to me that sex is the great driving force of sentient beings. Why, therefore, does Buddhism seem to tiptoe around the subject? Or does it simply fall under the larger category of desire?
Well, I haven't noticed that Buddhism actually tiptoeing around this subject at all. Interesting question, Phil. I'm going to change the first statement you make slightly. It seems to me that sex is a great driving force of sentient beings. If you say it's the great driving force of sentient beings, then I will just have to regard you in the same camp as Freud. But it is certainly a great driving force. It's a biological force, and one can arguably say that biology is basically the study of sex in all of its different manifestations. Does Buddhism tiptoe around the subject? Well, not exactly. Buddhism recognizes very explicitly that it is a great driving force. It's one of the reasons for the monastic code. It is such a great driving force that to be clear in one's relationship with one's sexuality and to be clear and completely present in the act of sex was regarded as something that was quite difficult and demanded a great deal of preparation. And it was a tremendous distraction for a lot of people. So the monastic code was developed to free people from that distraction by letting go of having explicit sexual relationships and working internally with the issue. And believe me, monks and nuns have to work very, very deeply internally with the issue. If you read the Vinaya or the ethical code, monastic ethical code, you will see that large sections of it deal with sex. So it does fall under the category of desire. It's a very explicit form of desire. It's one that many people find deeply challenging because there is so much biological potency in it that it strips away many of rational processes. I mean, who of us hasn't done something foolish in relationship with sex at some time in our lives? Looking back on it, we wonder how we can be so stupid, but sex does that to us. So it's very important. That's why in the ethical code of Buddhism, one is strongly recommended to bring attention to one's sexual relationships because they are such powerful areas for causing suffering and pain to ourselves and others. So being clear in one's relationship with one's sexuality, being clear in one's relationship, in one's sexual relationship with others, these are very, very important elements of Buddhist practice. And very challenging ones as well.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.